It's time for Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Michael, how are we doing?
I'm doing great. Always good to be here.
Lots of interesting things on the agenda to talk about this week. What's up first?
That's for sure. I thought I should just mention at the outset, of course, there's been all the discussion about that bank robbery the other day and a gun battle that ensued. The history in Victoria actually includes, I don't know if listeners can recall this, but from back in 1999 in Victoria, we had another notorious bank robbery that involved shooting at police in Victoria.
Yeah.
And back in 1999, that was Stephen Reed, right?
Yes, yep.
Had some notoriety from writing a book about his... a sort of a semi-autobiographical book about his involvement with the Stopwatch Gang, a group that had apparently engaged in some 100-plus highly organized bank robberies during the 1970s, netting millions of dollars. And then back in 1999, he was involved in the robbery of a bank in James Bay. I believe it was James Bay. And then there was a chase of Mr. Reed and police officer Bill Trudeau with Victoria Police wound up chasing him as he was firing at Bill Trudeau and a bystander with a shotgun.
Yeah, they went through Beacon Hill Park. I remember that.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then eventually he broke into the home of a James Bay couple and took them hostage and was eventually arrested later that night. He was convicted of attempted murder, and he got an 18-year sentence and passed away at age 68 back in 2018. Bill Trudeau, for his part, wound up receiving an award of valor for his efforts pursuing Mr. Reed while being shot at with a shotgun. And so these things don't happen frequently, happily. But you know, Victoria isn't a complete stranger to this sort of violent activity. And we'll, of course, watch with interest what happens here. And hopefully, of course, the officers that are still recovering are okay. You know, some of them are still in hospital.
Yeah.
You know, we should all be very thankful for what they did and the harm caused to them and the risk they put themselves at. In responding to this, and that does happen from time to time. That was one of the last notorious bank robberies in Victoria that involved shooting at police.
Yeah. In terms of legal affairs issues on the agenda this week, I do have it in front of me here. Are we still going to do that?
Yes. So first one I had on my on the agenda was a case that came out of the Highlands.
Yes.
Probably a topic that would arise for people at this time of the year, which was a dispute arising over work done on a deck. Right. I'm sure a lot of us enjoy spending time on the back deck as the sunny weather comes out. And this case is a bit of a cautionary tale. The background of it was that 25-plus years ago, the plaintiff eventually in the case built a home out in the Highlands and eventually moved in with his family after having obtained a temporary occupancy permit, but never had a final inspection done in his house. And then after 25 years, his wife had sadly passed away and his kids had moved out, and plaintiff decided he wanted to sell the house, but to do that, he needed to get some things fixed up. And he hired a contractor to do some work on the house, including replacing some decks and some other cosmetic work, but also to include work he wanted to replace just the surface of the main deck in the house. And he wanted to do that to try to, I think, save some money because he's planning to sell the house, so he didn't want to have the entire thing rebuilt. So the contractor spent several days and rebuilt various things and then replaced the just the surface of the main deck in the house. And in fact, he says he pointed out to the owner that, hey, the underside of this thing is pretty rotten, but nonetheless carried on and did what he said he was told to do and replaced just the top decking. Then the house got listed for sale, and of course, what happens next? Building inspector shows up and has a look at everything, and building inspector notes that The underside of the main deck is completely rotten and the thing's unsafe, and then notices some other bits and pieces that require work. And so the homeowner plaintiff blames the contractor and says, hey, you should have replaced this whole deck. It was rotten, not just on the top, which is what I asked you to do. And so on that basis, this thing wound up in court. And so the judge had to sort out what obligation did the contractor have, right? Should the contractor have done something more in terms of replacing the rotten underside of the main deck in the house? And the contractor's perspective was, hey, I wasn't asked to do that. I was just hired to replace the top of it. And I pointed out that the bottom was rotten, but, you know, how's that my responsibility? Ultimately, the homeowner wound up spending, I think, in excess of $50,000 having to replace, you know, the underside of the deck in order to get the building inspection to sell his house. And the judge ultimately, and this was interesting, found that even though the homeowner had only asked this contractor to do the top of the deck, the judge found that the contractor did have an obligation to make sure that this person replace the balance of it and not just screwing the top on, the new top onto a bunch of rotten wood underneath. But at the end of the day, the contractor shouldn't be responsible for the entire cost of rebuilding the man's deck. But instead, the judge found that the contractor was responsible for the extra work that was required and some of the wasted wood decking that couldn't be salvaged when the bottom was all rebuilt. And so after a three-day trial, the net result is that the homeowner was awarded some $5,000 in Supreme Court for some of the work that had to be done to get things up to snuff and for some of the extra work required because the contractor hadn't insisted upon redoing the bottom. And so ultimately, I suspect that the cost of hiring a lawyer to spend 3 days in court arguing about the deck is likely to have cost more than $5,000.
Yeah.
And yeah. As a side legal note, if you sue somebody in Supreme Court, right, and you wind up with an award that should have been in small claims court, which is where a $5,000 award should have been, presumptively, you don't get any costs awarded for you. And so that can make a big difference when you've had to spend or hire a lawyer to spend 3 days in court arguing about your deck repair. And so takeaways here for people would include, first of all, get it in writing, right? So you don't have a dispute about what was the oral agreement. Second of all, bear in mind if you're somebody who is the contractor, you're being relied upon, right, to some extent for sort of advice and what you're doing. It won't necessarily be a defense that you just say, well, he told me to screw it onto the rotten wood, so off I went, right? There can be some obligation to do more. And then finally, bear in mind, you know, think carefully about how much you might get at the end of the day, lest you spend more litigating your deck dispute that probably could have been avoided had you gotten it in writing and so forth. Then you might be awarded. So it's the case of the rotten deck, and probably something that many people are contemplating now as the weather looks warm, and we'd like a relaxing place to sit and enjoy it.
Always good advice. Another example, Michael, of why every person should have a will.
Yes, indeed. That is really important advice, and to keep it updated. And this case, which just came out, is from the BC Court of Appeal, just released. And it's an example of the sort of thing which can occur when somebody passes away and doesn't have a proper will. The background here is that the woman who passed away in 2016 had been married back in the 70s, but got divorced in the 80s. However, she maintained a good relationship with her ex-spouse. They would, you know, go for meals and spend time together. Then back in 2001, she created what was referred to as a testamentary document, which was a thing that didn't meet all the requirements of a will, but she was specifying what she wanted to happen to her possessions. And she referred to her ex-husband and said she wanted to give a good share of it to him because they had a good ongoing relationship. Then flash forward a number of years, and the woman had entered into a new relationship back in 2013. until she eventually passed away in 2016. When she passed away, you had this testamentary document from 2001 referencing the ex-husband, and then you had the new partner who had been living with her for the preceding 3 years. Both the new partner and the ex-husband from many years ago, with whom she maintained a good relationship, showed up at the respective courthouses and got orders to, in the case of the current partner, administer her estate on the basis that she had died without a will. And on the basis of the ex-husband, hey, I'm the person in charge of this. She was leaving things to me, right? And so off they go in litigation. And at trial, the judge found that the ex-husband didn't have a good claim because in several years after the woman had written out this testamentary document saying she wanted to leave things to him, she had created another document where she revoked all prior wills and so forth. And so that was the end of the claim for the ex-husband. But that wasn't the end of the matter. Because the judge at trial did an analysis of the relationship that the woman had with her new partner. And the way that works is under the Wills, Estates, and Succession Act, WESA, there's a provision that if somebody is in a marriage-like relationship, and that's the language used,
yeah,
with somebody for a period of the two years prior to their passing, then that person would be dealt with as a spouse, right?
Yes.
And the idea under the Wills, Estates, and Succession Act is that if somebody passes away and they have no will, the starting point is that all of their assets would be transferred to their spouse, right? Sort of the that act, the Wills, Estates, and Succession Act, I think is designed with sort of default outcomes for people's assets where there's no will. Right, sort of us. Well, what do we assume they would have wanted, I suppose? And in this case, there was a substantial estate. The woman owned a home in West Vancouver that after the mortgage might have been worth something in the order of $1 million. So there's a fair bit of money there.
Yeah.
So the Wills, Estates, and Succession Act has this default provision, goes to the spouse, but if no spouse, then there's sort of a list of down the rung of family members, starting with parents. And so the judge at the original trial went through this sort of checklist of things to try to determine, was this new fellow in a marriage-like relationship with the woman who passed away? And there are a whole bunch of things for the judge to think about, so it could be unclear what the outcome should be. And the judge in this case sort of went through with a tick list of things that came from, you know, previous cases and so on. And the judge had focused on the fact that even though the new person, they'd shared a bed together, and that, you know, he'd taken her to hundreds of medical appointments, did the grocery shopping, lived together, had meals together, celebrated events together, all these things that you would expect in a relationship, that there was little or no conjugal activity. And really focused on that, and then sort of weighed up this person's claim and sort of the relationship of this person and the friendly ex-husband, and found that this man, despite all these activities, didn't have a marriage-like relationship. The result of that is that the woman's estate would pass to her mother. The mother, sadly, herself passed away right during that trial. And so the net result is then her estate would have gone to her siblings, right?
Yeah.
And so none of this may have been what the woman had wanted to have happen to her estate, right? And so the matter then wound up going off to the Court of Appeal, which again is an example of what happens when there's ambiguity and no will and various people who think they might have some entitlement. And the Court of Appeal decision, which just came out, looked at how the trial judge had approached that issue of whether there was a marriage-like relationship. And one of the key points that the Court of Appeal made is that judges shouldn't approach it as sort of a checklist of factors. And the Court of Appeal pointed out that there's a large diversity of relationships that people have. And they're not all the same, and you shouldn't focus on sort of, you know, add up the tick marks on one side or the other. And found that the judge had placed undue weight on sort of conjugal relations and instead should have focused on the other things which I mentioned, right? They shared a bed together, they had meals together, they spent, celebrated holidays together.
Yes.
All the kinds of things you would expect in a relationship, and there just shouldn't have been an undue focus on that one element of it. And so the Court of Appeal reversed the decision that the trial judge had come to and found that indeed, and the Court of Appeal said, look, you're supposed to look at that 2 years prior to the person's passing. It's not a matter of trying to analyze what was going on 6 years ago or, what was the relationship like with the ex-husband and how did that compare, right? It's yeah. focusing on that period of time. And here, the relationship with the new partner had been from 2013 until 2016 when she passed away, and so found that, yes, indeed, this was a marriage-like relationship. And the result is that because there is no other valid will, her partner at the time of her passing should receive her estate. And so I think that's a good and fair outcome and probably in line with what she would have wanted. But bear in mind, this poor person passed away in 2016, and here we are sitting in 2022, and we finally have a decision out of the Court of Appeal. And boy, there could have been a lot of time, litigation, heartache, and uncertainty avoided had she created a will. And so the real takeaway for anyone listening, right, is just think about all the people involved and make sure that, if you take the time to prepare a will, you may save lots of strife and uncertainty and litigation. And here, the cost of this litigation, as the Court of Appeal ordered, will be payable out of the estate, right? And so all of this time and money has been spent trying to sort out what should happen with this woman's estate, whereas if she had simply prepared a will, all of this could have been avoided. And the other takeaway would be, don't try to do it yourself, as we saw in this case as well. What happens, this woman had prepared this thing the Court of Appeal referred to as a testamentary document, sort of her own, setting out her own desires, right, but without all of the formal requirements of a will, right, in terms of witnesses and so forth, right? So the small amount of money you might pay to hire a lawyer to help you prepare a proper will can save your beneficiaries and family endless heartache, time, expense, and so on. And I would just urge anyone who's listening who hasn't done that to consider doing it sooner rather than later to avoid just this kind of thing, and to make sure that your wishes are honored and you don't have family members and ex-husbands and brothers and sisters and everyone fighting over your estate. That may not be what you wanted, and the end result may not have been what you intended. And so please get that done. You'll save a lot of people a lot of grief.
The return of near normal after COVID-19, something that we discuss a lot. I know the criminal justice system is likely to stay in hybrid model to some degree for a while, but I'm reading here that we're going to see, does this say a return to normal criminal jury trials in August?
We're almost back.
Almost back.
We're doing our best. We're almost back. Now, I should say, there are some things which we adopt in the criminal justice system during the course of COVID that hopefully will stay, because they've turned out just to be generally good and useful time-saving advances, right? Like, we're continuing to use lots of things like MS Teams and so on to have virtual proceedings when those are appropriate, like sentencings in a lot of cases where there's nobody seeking a jail sentence, everyone's agreed that it should be a fine or something, right?
Yeah.
Are being done by video. They're doing bail hearings often now by video. That's the default. So you can use judicial time efficiently. There's all kinds of things that have been adopted during the pandemic that hopefully we stick with, because they're working pretty well. But some things just don't work that way, one of them being jury trials. That was perhaps the most challenging thing during the pandemic, because you've got people that have to be squeezed together, they've got to deliberate, you've got to choose the jury, and you've got people that are not there voluntarily, right? In most human affairs, you can make your own call. Hey, do you want to go to the restaurant? Are you still feeling a bit skittish, right?
Yeah.
That's up to you. But when you're getting a jury notice, that's not up to you. And so we're now returning to an almost normal. So as of August 15th, the BC Supreme Court has announced that they're going to be revoking remaining things like courthouse capacity limits and physical distancing requirements. The wearing of face masks is going to be sort of optional, either up to the individual, subject to the direction from a judge. They could say, for some reason, you know, let's say you had somebody on the jury who had it was immunocompromised or something. You could have a judge say, no, we're going to require this, right? So it's up to the individual judge. So that's returning. And so that will allow jury trials to resume in all of the locations across the province where they used to occur. They had restricted that because they needed places that were a bit more spaced out. Now, one of the things which at this point is going to continue, which was adopted as part of a COVID protocol, but may have some merit going forward as an efficiency matter, is having this what's referred to as sort of a two-part jury selection process. And the way it used to work, when you got a notice to show up for jury duty, is you would get a notice to show up along with 200 of your closest friends, or whatever was needed for jury selection, because there could be multiple juries picked on the same day.
Yes.
And everyone would pile into the courthouse and sit cheek to jowl, and then they would draw names out of a box at random to determine who the prospective jurors would be, and then they would go through them. You know, is there some reason they can't serve? Do they know the witness? Are they the friend of the accused? What's going on here, right? Is there some challenge? And so it would require everyone to be there while all that happened. What they've done during COVID and what will stay in a slightly modified form is a two-step process. So the idea is hundreds of jury notices would go out. People would then be required to show up, though, in smaller, show up sort of on one occasion where they would then draw names and determine who are going to be the prospective jurors. Everyone else would then be excused, and the people who were drawn and some additional ones in case there was a problem, somebody couldn't serve, would be asked to come back another day when they would go through that second part of the vetting, determining, like, do you know the witnesses, or are you a friend of the accused, or is there some reason why you can't do this next week, whatever it might be, to avoid having the crush of people that have to show up and all wait around while all that happens. And so they're going to stick with that, but there'll be a slight modification in that the hope is that they will be able to return to doing that first part of it with the group showing up during the week. They were doing that on the weekend, in locations to sort of spread people out and have fewer people in the courthouse. But as of August 15th, they're sticking with the two-stage thing to reduce the amount of time people have to be there, but are going to return to doing it during the week. So we're almost back to normal. August 15th, and let's hope we don't have a 7th or 8th or 9th wave or whatever it might be. Because, of course, this is an important part of the justice system, and hopefully we get it back on track, preserving some of the things that were invented over COVID, which still seem like a good idea, even without the risk of contagion.
Absolutely. Michael Bulligan, always a pleasure. Thanks for your time. We'll see you next week.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
All right. During the second half of our second hour every Thursday on CFAX, Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. This has been Legally Speaking.